with it. So I said, what are you? And then he became, and I got very inspired by him, and he inspired me to ordain. He introduced me to the Pali Canon, the Sila, all kinds of good things. And we were going to, that was in 71, 72, late 71. And we were going to, he inspired me to ordain. Interesting what inspired me, actually, because I had a taste for awareness practice, but I had no idea for lifestyle. And although he introduced me to the Pali Canon, which I liked, and Venerable Jnanavira Tara's notes, but then one day he spoke about Vinaya and the monastic life, and I saw lights. I said, that's how I could do it. And, you know, if you would have seen me a year before that, you, a monk? I don't think so. And then he... Right, and then we decided that he wanted to go to Nepal. And I invited him to stay with me for a while, for a vasa. And then he decided he wanted... Yeah, he was ordained in Sri Lanka. And he thought the meditation teachers might be better in Thailand. He's on his way to Thailand. So he wanted to visit Nepal. We were going to meet in Calcutta. And join up in Calcutta and then head over to Bangkok. So he went off to Nepal. And I was still in an arm. And then I got a postcard saying he had disrobed, which is a bummer. Then I lost my nerve, so I just stayed up in the mountains. Then I got hepatitis, and I didn't have any money, so I didn't want to go to a hospital. So then I kind of fasted and marginally got my health back together. And then my grandfather died, and I had to go back for the funeral. So and my grandfather's living in Germany. We're back for the funeral, and the interesting thing is, I've told many people the story. One of the interesting things about this story is that I got back to Europe then, and I was broke, and I needed to get some money, so I visited my brother in Paris first and ate for a month. I was just so thin. I was just so thin, and I just ate. And I kind of bloomed. I had this baby fat on me. I just like put on. I was in India for a year and a half without money and hepatitis and all that. So then I had some friends in Bern, in Switzerland, and I worked construction 6 months. I remember the first day after that, I hadn't worked for a long time. Everything hurt. Every muscle imaginable hurt. But during that time, somewhere, I lost this urge to ordain. And I lost it so fundamentally, I forgot about it. You know, it's interesting how old karma can just dominate again. And then I was, like, I'd worked 6 months. So it was around late in the year in Bern, and I decided I had enough money, I'll travel again. I'd been traveling for about 3 years. So I had this wacky idea. I'll go to Hamburg and get a boat, work my way across to South America. So I went up to Hamburg, and I walked along the docks looking for some work, and it was the most degenerate place. It was awful. And I had this tremendous despair. What are you doing with your life? You know, where are you going? And I went to Hamburg University, because I could speak German now, and I sort of hung out in U of T for a while. And so I had a sense of universities. And I went into a student travel bureau, and I asked the person at the counter, "Can you give me a list of flights?" And the person said, "Where to?" I said, "I don't care." I just no idea. And this awful kind of sense of lack of purpose, the lady gives me a list of possibilities, and I run my finger down. First one is, I hit Bangkok. That's it. 2 weeks later, I was in Bangkok. Month later, I was in the robe.
Wow.
And probably 2 months after that, I met Ajahn Chah. It's kind of the whole thing is like, definitely not self. I don't know who invented that story, because I mean, it did happen, but it's something bigger than, my sort of plan. But what was interesting, I had this incredible inspiration to be a bhikkhu, and yet I forgot that. I kind of got drowned. And my mother of course, thought she'd lost her boy. She had to wait. But my parents thought I had gone off the deep end, because they were pretty worried about me anyway. And they thought, he's really lost the plot now. So they didn't, it's so painful for them, me becoming a monk. So my mother eventually, my parents came to visit England when I was in England, and Ajahn Chah was there, and she met Ajahn Chah, totally distrusted the man. Just totally, who is this guy? And Ajahn Chah's answer was, "Don't worry, your son is safe now." And it was true. He kind of really understood that. And then about, am I doing a life story here? Yes. And then about pretty early, it was in Thailand, so it would have been about, so I'm into this monk thing for about 3 years. And I had this tremendous sense of gratitude to my parents. Tremendous. And he's a kind of young kid in a monastery, all idealistic. And I go to Ajahn Chah, "Oh, Paul, I have to disrobe." He says, "Why?" I have to go take care of my parents. I just feel all this gratitude. I want to go take care of them. He says, "How old are they?" Tell him the age. He said, "Are they sick?" "No." "Do they have some money?" "Yeah." He said, "And have you ever felt this way before?" I said, "Not like this." He said, "You see, the practice is working." So now you just stay here, and then eventually when your parents really need you, you'll be available for them, which again was very true. It's a bio. Autobio. Mm-hmm. Autobio. So that was 72. So this reading from Lumpo Liam. When we take refuge in Buddha Dharma Sangha, I've been using it in a kind of the way of the contemplative, but also the conventional way of having faith in the Buddha. Is one of the articles of faith in a Buddhist lifestyle is that there is enlightenment, and that there is a being who has realized this, and that there are beings who are doing this work and are successful, and that's known as the Arya Sangha. Arya is noble meaning these beings have profound attainment or profound realization. So to me, I have this sort of dual way of contemplating refuge. When I think of Buddha as awake, but Buddha also as a human being, it gives me a sense of optimism for the human condition, that as human beings we do have profound possibility. and we can practice, and we can. There is the law of karma, which allows us to train that we're not. You know, the teaching isn't deterministic in some way where you're just stuck with your karma, as it were. It's not that at all. That we can make choices, that we can notice cause and effect, that we can pick up the teaching, that we can develop as human beings. Huh? So to me, the Buddha is this great being in the distant past who actually did the work and then had tremendous barami, tremendous virtue to, first of all, to attain, to make this have this realization. Then he had the barami and skill of analysis, because when one reads about the people who have a good sense of the Pali Canon, they do say it's one mind that's put this together. And you could say what was a compilation historical, which would be good too. And there is that, but there's a sense of there was one being who had these tremendous powers of analysis that. And I haven't read that much really, but when you look at it, when he analyzes, when there's the analysis of morality or of friendship or of mental factors for concentration, so many things, it's really quite intellectually, it's a stunning piece of work, that Pali Canon. So the power of his analysis, the power of creating an order, a monastic order that. And it is still kind of viable now, 2,600 years later. And we do the Patimokkha, the fortnightly recitation of the rules at the monastery. And I always think, I think, look at, there's four blokes, Atalo, myself, Pamuto, and Subaru, and then some in training, and we're just up in Perth, right? Just looking at the deer and trying to get enlightened. And it's this, you know, it's really the same that was happening in India so many years ago. And it's quite for me, awe-inspiring that this social system, the social structure, still works. It really is, because it's very practical. Vinaya lives are very practical. It's a doing. So someone who had the social skills and the group of his communities, who then developed this whole lifestyle with all its rules and regulations and ways of communal cooperation and so on. So that to me, that reflection on the Buddha is very inspiring. And I think inspiration is an important part of our spiritual life, because sometimes it's certainly hard work. Certainly hard work. And then, in a sense, of the Dharma being also the documented part, the doctrine is. I think it's important to, like, I don't teach obviously academically. I'm just not skilled in that, and maybe not interested. But I think it's very helpful to know the difference between Theravada Buddhism and Rumi, right? To know the difference between Theravada Buddhism and Mahayana Buddhism. Not because of doctrine, but because each have their own way of directing the mind to liberation, I think. And of course, if one hasn't put the effort forth, the academic effort, just to, you know, really get in consciousness what the Four Noble Truths are, dependent origination, three characteristics, just some basics, then I think intellectually sometimes doubts can come up, which wouldn't if you had a good clear understanding of those kind of the basic fundamentals. So those are good things to get your head around. Take a book on the Four Noble Truths and take some commentaries on it, read several versions, and then you find that you branch off into bits of that, and you get a good solid basis of contemplation, investigation. Otherwise, it's kind of like you've got a recipe for dal and you've got a recipe for blueberry pancakes, you know, and you're cooking the dal and you start to put the blueberries in the dal and you think, it doesn't taste right, I'll put some honey in. No, how about some molasses, you know, and it's a whole thing. It doesn't quite taste right. But, you know, dal is cooked this way, blueberry pancakes this way. They both taste good. They're both nourishing in some way. So just the very word, like Buddha nature, even the word arahant, enlightened being, is used differently in Mahayana as opposed to Theravada. Right? That's my first years, where, especially with Venerable Bodhisattva, who was my first teacher, it was intellectually very challenging, just kind of getting my head around dependent origination and where do they all fit together. It was a good intellectual struggle, I suppose. It was a nice challenge, and he was very, very clear, very helpful. But once I kind of understood it as a piece, I found that very, very helpful, very helpful. And of course, when I was in India, I didn't have that many options. I wasn't really interested in Tibetan Buddhism. And so, fortunately, I was pretty much honed in on Theravada teachings, and all these other things which are available now weren't really available. So I think then the Dharma does have a doctrinal structure to it. Again, so I use Dharma in these two ways. One is this is the way things are. That's the most profound, because the other is pointing to that. And then the doctrinal part helps me to see where grasping is, what letting go is about, and so on. And then the Sangha, I use also in a kind of twofold way. There's the Arya Sangha. So for me, the Arya Sangha are those beings who have accomplishments, like Lompo Liam, Lompo Cha, and I think Lompo Sumedho and others. And I look to them as my both role models and also for teaching, if they're alive. And then Sangha as a kind of a personal thing, it's the practices that we do, or that I do, the practices of living by my own moral codes and disciplines, and practices of meditation and contemplation and so on. So the Buddha Dhamma Sangha has this sort of twofold way of being contemplated. One is like the conventional, the external maybe, and one is the inner. But just reading Lompo Liam, hopefully that's uplifting, you know, that the possibility of human enlightenment is there, and that it is greater than just a kind of another book on the what do they call that? Get better, not self-improvement. You know, on the self-improvement shelf, right? 10 ways to be a better nerd, or something like that. the beings who have accomplished, they've worked very hard. You know, you see their accomplishments don't come with a lot of effort. But in our Buddhist way of looking at things, we would say that they come into this life with parami. Parami is the idea of virtue. And then we call them the virtuous qualities, and parami in the Thai system is the idea of accumulated virtue. You know, that beings come into this; they're already accomplished in various ways. And you read about their lives; they just right away have a very moral character, and samadhi comes easily, and they're very reflective. Like in the same way, I think, well, why did I become a monk? Why did I pick up this Buddhism? Well, to me, it seems more than just a little trip to India. It kind of seems there's something deeper going on. But however that works, we have what we have. You know, we have our pluses and minuses, our strengths and weaknesses. We have our kind of karmic stuff, as they say. And hopefully these inspiring beings kind of really impel us to work hard in this practice. But we practice for the sake of practice. The danger, of course, of presenting any word of accomplishment is that, of course, I get greedy to have that happiness or that peace, and then that very greed prevents me from just being patient with the way things are. So we practice for the sake of practice, and just letting go.